It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strangechamps. Today, survival. We're going to meet some of the oldest living things on the planet and a NASA scientist with a list of everything you need to know after the apocalypse. But first, there's one thing no one can survive, and that's death. Unless, well, it depends on just how dead you are. Sam Parnia is an intensive care doctor with a sought-after medical specialty, resurrection. He can bring patients back to life hours after they die. Parnia teaches at the Stony Brook University School of Medicine, and he's at the forefront of the new science of resuscitation. Steve Paulson sat down with him to talk about erasing death.
Sam, I have to say, I always thought I knew what death is. It's what happens when your heart stops and your brain stops functioning, but it's actually a bit more complicated than that, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's an evolving understanding that we have. And the reason why most people, including perhaps most physicians, actually have this perception of a sort of a fixed moment, you know, to most people listening to the program, if you were to say a person is dead, for them that's absolute finite and there's a moment that you get there, and then when you get there you can't come back again. And the reason for that is because if you look back historically through centuries and millennia, essentially when the heart stopped beating, a person would then immediately stop breathing, the brain would immediately stop functioning, and that's why doctors shine a light on the eyes and they demonstrate that you have these fixed and dilated pupils of the eye, demonstrating that the brain stem and the reflexes of the brain have stopped functioning. And that was the moment of death. And that is still the moment of death that is used in hospitals to give someone, for instance, a time of death that's put on a death certificate. However, what we've now come to understand, and really through progress in resuscitation science over the last 50 years, and in particular the last 10 years, is that essentially it's only after a person has died and turned into a corpse. And I just want to be clear, I'm not playing with words, I'm not trying to be ambiguous, I'm really talking about someone who's literally died. And to take this to the extreme, imagine someone who, say, was in the French Revolution who had their head guillotined off. I mean, as dead as you can imagine, okay? Mm-hmm. When you become a corpse, it's only at that time that the cells inside the body start to undergo their own process of death. And that actually brain cells can remain viable while non-functioning for a lot longer than we thought, perhaps many hours of time.
So just to be clear about this, you're saying that it's possible for people to die in the technical definition of death and yet still come back to life.
Absolutely. So it's not that it's possible if people do die, but what is possible is to still bring them back for a significant period of time after they have died. And the reason for that is because the cells inside the body have not yet become irreversibly damaged as a consequence of the lack of oxygen that's getting to them. And we used to think that we only had 4 or 5 minutes before brain cells would become irreversibly damaged. And now we know that was completely wrong, that we have many hours of time. And therefore, the art and science of resuscitation of the 21st century is learning how to manipulate those cellular changes that are occurring in the brain cells and other cells to prevent them from going to a point where they're irreversibly damaged, while at the same time restarting the heart and bringing back a whole person without brain damage.
This sounds like a strange definition of death. I mean, I guess, why not just say that someone dies when they are gone once and forever? Why say that, you know, death is this thing that happens, you know, after cardiac arrest, but they still can come back?
Well, the reason for that is because, and you pointed out something here, most people, when they hear the term cardiac arrest, they think you're talking about like a subset of people who've died, say, from a heart attack. Cardiac arrest is not a heart attack. Cardiac arrest is a medical term for death. It's when the heart stops beating for whatever reason. Say someone who's in a motor vehicle accident, meningitis, they've cancer, whatever you can think of that causes a person to die. When they die, that's called cardiac arrest. Now, what we're finding is that the advances in resuscitation science are beginning to challenge our understanding of what death really is. So we used to think clearly there's a black and white, you know, you're either dead or you're alive. And now we know that there's this long and significant period after you die in which you enter this gray zone where death can be reversed. Now, clearly, if you leave someone long enough, the cells inside the brain will become so damaged that no matter what you do, you can't bring them back again. But no one really knows how long that time is. So should you wait, say, an hour or 2 hours or 10 hours or 6 hours after a person has died before being certain that their cells are now irreversibly damaged?
So what do scientists know now that they didn't know 10 or 20 years ago? I mean, why has this ability to bring people back after death, why has it expanded so much?
Well, the key discoveries, I think, that have happened perhaps more so in the last 10 years is that essentially the notion that we had that we only have 4 or 5 minutes after you deprive brain cells of oxygen leads to absolute irreversible brain cell damage has now been shown not to be correct. And therefore, we now know that cell death is a biological process that takes place through enzymatic processes. In other words, there are catalysts, chemical catalysts, that lead to cells to die. And therefore, if you learn how to manipulate those, you can therefore bring back a whole person. And that's really where the focus has become, and that's what we are dealing with.
So how do you do that? How do you slow down cell death?
We know that chemical changes from high school chemistry need heat. So if you were to cool down the body, you will slow down the rate by which the chemical steps that are taking a brain cell that's potentially viable into a state of irreversible damage is taking place. You can slow down that rate. Now, we're not talking about cryogenics. We're not talking about freezing. We're talking simply about chilling the body from 99 degrees to, say, 92 degrees Fahrenheit. So just a little bit.
And is there anything else besides cooling the body that you're doing?
You find there are things done in other countries. For instance, in Japan and South Korea, as well as Taiwan, one of the things that's pretty much their standard of care in many of their hospitals, even in the emergency rooms, is they have a device called extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. And as the name suggests, or abbreviated to ECMO, it's essentially a system by which they take blood out of a person's body, they siphon it out, it goes to a membrane, and the membrane delivers oxygen to it, and then it's pumped around the body. And by doing that, they're giving their doctors hours of time to slow down the rate by which brain cells are dying and go back and fix the underlying problem that caused the person to die, say a heart attack or a road traffic accident, that young person who hemorrhaged, go back, try and fix the problem and get them back again. And they're having enormous success by doing that. But incredibly, in the United States, it is not standard of care. You'll be lucky if they have it at a hospital. And if they do have it, it's very patchy, whether they use it for these patients or not. And so that is a real game changer we found in this field.
This is really remarkable, what you're talking about. I mean, just what science, what medicine has discovered about how to bring people back to life. And we should talk some about case histories here. I mean, you've had a lot of personal contact with these, and you tell some remarkable stories in your book, Erasing Death. Tell me about Joe Tirolosi.
He's a 57-year-old gentleman who was a chauffeur driver who came to Cornell Medical Center, where I used to work. And essentially, as soon as he arrived, his heart stopped, and he died. He came, and he had almost 50 minutes of CPR, where most doctors at that point would have given up on him. And incredibly, the doctors who were on went on for longer, and eventually, at about that time, they managed to restart his heart, while at the same time, as we said, cooled him down, using primitive stuff, ice packs, taking literally bags, filling up from the drinks vending ice machine, and putting it all over his body, cooling him down to preserve his cells. And then he was taken to the cardiac catheterization laboratory, and they found that he has a massive heart attack, which is what had caused him to die. They fixed the problem, took him to the coronary care unit, and they all thought he's going to be brain damaged because he had such a long period of cardiac arrest. But incredibly, he recovered, and when they took him out of his coma, he started telling the nurses and people there that he had this very profound experience that had completely changed him. So it put together a number of the most critical elements in bringing a person back.
And the profound experience you just mentioned is what we would call a near-death experience, although you don't actually like that word, do you?
Yes. Traditionally, people have called these near-death experiences. And it's interesting, if you look back at the history, CPR was discovered in 1960. So it was only then that medicine found the way to bring more and more people back to life after they would have traditionally been declared dead and could not have come back again. And by 1975, the first book was published that described these incredible experiences that people were having when they'd been critically ill and sometimes going beyond the threshold of death, in other words, having a cardiac arrest. Now, unfortunately, at that time, this was so new, and the person who wrote it, his background was philosophy and he was a psychiatrist.
This is Raymond Moody.
Raymond Moody, that's right. He termed these near-death experiences, which at the time I think was appropriate, but now looking back scientifically is enormously problematic because there is no such term as being near death in medical science. There is no such thing in intensive care. You may be dead or alive, but there's no such thing as being near it.
So what's the phrase that you would prefer then?
We know the biology of cardiac arrest incredibly well, and it's the same for everyone. So it's standardized, and it allows us to be precise and to study it very precisely. And therefore, the experiences that they have after going through cardiac arrest, which is the same as death, I refer to as an actual death experience, which is very different to this ambiguous, vague sort of collection of experiences that have been put under the umbrella term of near-death experiences.
Sam Parnia is an intensive care doctor, director of resuscitation research at Stony Brook University School of Medicine, and he's the author of the book Erasing Death. Steve Paulson's talked with him. Even with advanced medical science, the human lifespan just isn't that long, comparatively speaking. I mean, take the longest living humans. Jean Calment of France died at age 122. Jeromon Kimura of Japan was 116 when he died. But there's a shrub in Tasmania that's 43,600 years old. And there's a patch of seagrass in Spain that's more than 100,000 years old. Photographer Rachel Sussman has documented 30 of these oldest living things in the world, and she just came out with a gorgeous coffee table book of her photos, along with stories about her very long-lived subjects. To visit them, she has traveled all over the world, including to Antarctica.
I was there to photograph this 5,500-year-old moss, and it was wonderful even just to learn that there was something that old living on Antarctica. But the other thing that was so wonderful for me was that I just had finished reading Endurance, the Shackleton expedition story. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that we ended up following in Shackleton's footsteps a bit because this moss that I was after lives on Elephant Island, and that happens to be the same spot where Shackleton and his crew were marooned, I believe, for almost a year.
So you went there to look for this 5,500-year-old moss. What was it like to actually find it?
Certainly that was incredibly satisfying. I did about 2 years of research before making this trip. So I had heard about the moss sort of just through a rumor, really. So I immediately started looking for published research. But it took me a while to track that down. But once I did, I spoke to the scientists who had discovered it. And this was around 25 years ago that they'd made the discovery. And as far as we knew, nobody had laid eyes on this moss since then. So it was really a big question about whether I'd be able to find it. And that had been the days before GPS. So I actually contacted the Polar Geospatial Research Center, who then provided me with some satellite maps. And, you know, I certainly will never forget the moment when I was standing on the bridge of the ship with binoculars looking out at this point, an Elephant Island, and actually saw it. Mm-hmm. And it was incredibly it was humbling.
What does it look like?
Everything in Antarctica does look white. But as you get closer, you realize that it's far more nuanced. So as I got closer into the island, you could see the green of the moss against some of certainly the rocky outcroppings and those sort of geologic structures, as well as the snow and glaciers behind it.
But one of the things that's so striking about this is you're talking about 5,500-year-old moss, and it exists. It's survived on one of the most inhospitable places on the planet. It's one thing to have survived that long. It's another thing to have survived that long in such conditions. How do you even begin to explain that?
It's absolutely fascinating, and also something that I feel like connects a lot of my subjects, in that they tend to live in very inhospitable climates and living in extremes of temperature, extreme elevations. We have things that are underwater. We have organisms that live with very low nutrient availability.
Things in deserts.
Yes, that was an exciting thing to find as well, that a number of the connecting factors have to do with living in difficult circumstances and yet being uniquely adapted to thrive in them.
yeah, it's just, it's fascinating. I mean, I'm thinking right off the bat, there's a photograph you have. It's not even very impressive to look at. It looks like a little bit of green sort of scrub. It's not a big patch of green in the middle of what looks like just this desert. And then you say it's an underground forest?
That was a very interesting one to learn about as well. Yeah, so the underground forest, this was a phenomena that I learned about from a botanist in South Africa at the Pretoria Botanical Garden. And I'd actually gone to South Africa looking for baobab trees. And he said, oh, have you heard of this phenomena of these different plants that actually migrated underground as an evolutionary tactic to protect themselves from frequent fires that occur in the region? And of course, I'd never heard of this. And he said, actually, a lot of botanists have never even heard of this phenomena. So collectively, they're known as the underground forests, and they're growing clonally, which means they're self-propagating. And the one that I photographed was thought to be around 13,000 years old. But
wow.
Unfortunately, it is no longer with us. So this was some very sad news that I learned, but they changed the traffic pattern. This was outside of the gates of the botanical garden there, and they just bulldozed right over the poor thing.
Oh, my gosh. I can't imagine. I mean, the sense of loss at losing something 13,000 years old.
This isn't the only one of my subjects that we've lost in the past 5 years alone. And considering that I only photographed 30 organisms, losing two is not a very good statistic.
Well, this really gets at one of the other reasons you wanted to do the project in the first place. You know, it's to document and hopefully kind of call attention to these amazing plants, you know, some of the oldest living things on the planet, and hopefully to help people try to preserve them.
Absolutely. I think that collectively, these organisms really symbolize something that transcends us all and can connect us all and hopefully forge some understanding that, you know, we all are part of this global ecosystem. And as climate change becomes more and more of a clear and present danger, I'm hoping that by looking at these organisms that have survived through millennia, that might help us remember that these individuals have persevered, but they are in danger at our hands. And they are in danger. And it's up to us to step in and protect them.
So how old are the oldest living things on Earth?
So the oldest known living organism is the Siberian actinobacteria, which is between 400,000 and 600,000 years old.
I can't even think of time in those scales. Put it in some perspective, can you?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I think, you know, that's certainly another aspect of the project as a whole, is that I'm trying to help connect to these deeper time scales that are so outside of our human understanding of what a long time is. So the Siberian actinobacteria was discovered by a team of planetary biologists who were looking for clues to life on other planets. And they took some core samples into the permafrost in Siberia and ended up finding what is now thought to be the oldest living thing on the planet. So it's really a fantastic discovery, but also goes to show how little we know about life on Earth, that there's so much more to discover.
What's the oldest living thing in this country?
The oldest living thing in the United States is known as Pando. It's a clonal colony of quaking aspen trees that lives in Utah, and it happens to be 80,000 years old.
Oh, my God. 80,000. So you have to explain what a clonal colony is. This means that it's not a single thing that's been living continuously for 80,000 years, right?
It actually is. It's certainly, if you bear with me here for a moment. So if you think about a single tree that's a unitary organism, we get that, a big giant sequoia. A giant sequoia is a single unitary organism. So if you can imagine a forest, forest that is technically a single tree. And what I mean by that, it is one giant interconnected root system. And each trunk is actually a stem coming out from that system. So what you have is one giant genetically identical individual. And a single stem might not live more than 200 or 300 years, but the entire organism has been alive for around 80,000.
Wow. What's it like to walk amongst those trees?
Well, aspen trees are incredibly beautiful, even the ones that aren't that old. So to have that extra layer of knowledge that this organism has been around for that long is really breathtaking. And it's a way to connect and step back into this deeper time right now in the present.
It's a lovely phrase, deep time. I mean, what does it mean to you?
Deep time is something that I'd been thinking about for a while, even before I'd started this work. And, you know, to me, it's something that it certainly still has a level of abstraction to it, but it's something that is beyond our, almost our, beyond our physiological ability to process time into something that becomes abstract, but also connects us to things like geologic time, cosmic time, and the story that we are a part of, but that we're part of a continuum, and we're a very small part of that continuum. And that could be a little scary, but I think it's also really wonderful and can really create a sense of awe and wonder.
Photographer Rachel Sussman's new collection of photographs is called The Oldest Living Things in the World. To see some of those photos, visit our website at ttbook.org. I'm Anne Strainchamps. We've got more stories of survival coming up on To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about survival in this hour. I suppose most of us have, at one time or another, imagined surviving some sort of global meltdown. And if you haven't, you must not watch much TV. Listener Rebecca Demarest recently sent us a short story about a group of survivors scrabbling out a living after a civilization has crashed and burned. It's called Patchwork Flight.
There had always been stories told in whispers around the evening meal, rapidly hushed as the adults came close, because we weren't supposed to know them. Stories of decay-infested cities and the ruinous end they'd come to. But my friends whispered stories of music and dancing that would last for days, giant buildings where people could trade for food, and gleaming machines that carried you through the skies like birds. Those captured my imagination. To be able to soar above the clouds, it seemed like a dream. But we were trapped on this island. Our ancestors destroyed all their landing crafts and machines to start society afresh without all the failings of the ancient Romans and Americans. Machines make you weak, make you complacent and lazy. So we toil by hand. But to be able to fly... One day, as I strung laundry out to dry, the water-heavy fabric caught in the wind and ballooned, straining against the line. I pulled it tight, feeling the resistance pull me forward. I let the sheet go, and it whipped away again. That week, I went to the rag baskets in the laundry and took some scraps I thought no one would need. I stitched them carefully together, then I took some dowels we use for growing beans and built a frame. Something to hold the bit of cloth tight against the wind. It wasn't stealing. I'd return it to the stores when I was through. At this point, I would have happily broken all of our laws just to watch my project fly. I snuck out to the beach during a rest period and waited for a breeze to catch the patchwork. But it stayed quivering on the sand. I tried throwing it into the wind, only to have it blow back in my face. I wanted to cry. This should work. Should fly, just like a bird. If I couldn't get this bit of cloth into the air, how could I ever build something that could carry me up and away? The bell tolled the end of the rest period. I had to run. If I was late, someone would ask where I'd been. So I ran. And it flew. Straight up into the air, soaring against the clouds. I tugged and watched it respond, zigging and zagging across the sky. It was flying. I didn't realize how long I stared at the sky until a brother came to find me.
Hey, give that to me.
I hid it behind me, ashamed, terrified of the expression on his face. But he was older and bigger, and in a blink, I was on the sand, and the contraption was in his hands. He threw it into the air, but it fell and slammed onto the sand.
Make it fly! How did you make it fly?
He shook me so hard I couldn't remember and just stood there, mute. He growled in frustration and threw it in the air again, and the wind threw it back at him, gashing his face.
Damn it! You must have bewitched it. You're using science, aren't you?
His face contorted at the thought of the old contaminant, that brain poison that killed entire cultures.
Show me how to make it fly or I'm turning you in.
He hit me so hard with the wooden cloth, my scalp split and the frame broke.
Patchwork Flight, a story written by, to the best of our knowledge, listener Rebecca Demarest, was performed by Sarah Nix and Nigel O'Shea, with sound design by Brittany True. Science fiction has a view of the future that tends to be pretty bleak, doesn't it? There's been a pandemic or a nuclear war. Most of humanity is wiped out. Armed vigilantes steal your stuff and eat your family. The good news is you can survive all this if you have the knowledge. That's the title of a new book by NASA astrobiologist Lewis Dartnell. The subtitle, How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch. It's a list of everything we'd need to know to reboot. And if that seems overly optimistic, Lewis told Charles Monroe Kane he expects rationality and morality will prevail, even after the apocalypse.
I'm not naive, and clearly, with the evaporation of law and order, things will get brutal and unpleasant, and there'll be a great deal of violence, and the strong will try to dominate the weak. But, I mean, there have been dissolutions of society and law and order in history, and things recover, and an equilibrium is reached, and kind of normality ensues. And so all of these post-apocalyptic films or kind of sci-fi books that we've read, we're familiar with this trope. We've all seen I Am Legend or
right.
The Road. We know about that kind of period. But no one ever talks about what comes next.
You've had this collapse
of civilization. You've had that period of brutality. People are now in a stable society, ready to start trying to recover and, you know, retrieve the capability that we had before. So how do you build a civilization from scratch?
You're an astrobiologist, and you've written this amazingly dense book that's practical on how to survive post-apocalypse. Why?
It's something that interests me. So I'm a scientist. I'm a research scientist. I work in a lab. And you're right, my primary research is in astrobiology and understanding the limits of survival of life on Earth and comparing that to the environment we think used to exist on Mars, and therefore whether there's a possibility of life on Mars and what signs of life to look for and how we could detect it. But that's not so far from thinking about the very fundamentals, not of life, but of civilization. What does civilization require? What conditions does it need? How does it provide for itself in the way that life might provide for itself? So yeah, I don't see them as being two completely distinct things. They have been useful kind of with each other to a certain extent.
One thing your book gets at, which kind of scared me more than anything else,
yeah.
is that there's a possibility that we could lose that collective knowledge. And you get into talking about not just storing canned goods or learning how to make your own soap, but storing knowledge and actually the idea of the collective knowledge we need, our future selves need, to survive. Where did that come from? Where's the idea that we need to do that? Because I'm also surprised that we don't do that.
As you're saying, the reason for this is that over history, as civilization has complexified and become more sophisticated, each of us have become ever more specialized and focused in the kind of niche, in the role we perform in civilization. And you get kind of, you know, layer built upon layer. You get this vast kind of pyramid of kind of roles building on each other. And this wasn't true, you know, hundreds of years ago, and perhaps during the mid-1300s, when the Black Death, the bubonic plague, raged across Europe and killed perhaps a third of the population at the time. And it could have been a truly cataclysmic civilization-ending event, but it wasn't. It kind of retarded us a bit. But people kind of brushed themselves off and just gone on with life, because back then they did have all of these practical skills and experience and the expertise to make things for themselves and do things for themselves.
Yeah, they were closer to the basics.
Exactly, closer to the means of production, closer to growing food for themselves and stitching their own clothes and using a spinning wheel and a loom. I mean, how many of us have actually ever seen a loom or a spinning wheel with our own eyes rather than just a picture on Wikipedia? I mean, I certainly hadn't. And that's what's interesting, has been interesting me while I've been researching this, is that kind of disconnect that I think every one of us in the modern world feels, this kind of slight sense of dissatisfaction that we don't really have any idea anymore how any of this stuff is done for us. It just magically appears on the supermarket shelves or on the clothes in a shopping store. And I think people are interested. And the one thing I hope that people take away after reading the knowledge is just a little bit more appreciation about how all this stuff is done for us, and that incredible, like I say, those kind of processes and principles that support all of our everyday lives without us really realizing it.
What do we need to know, theoretically? Not how to use a bellows or how to use a sextet, but what do we need to know, theoretically, that we really need, that's imperative to have after an apocalypse? What are the theories and ideas that we must bring forward?
I allowed myself about 300 pages for the knowledge to condense it down. Let's say you had only a few pages. You could preserve and transmit to the society that came after us just a few pages of text. What would you describe? What would you explain? And if I were kind of forced for that, you know, limited to that very tight word count, I think the greatest invention of them all, the one thing you would try to preserve above all others, would be the scientific method, that this machinery for generating new knowledge. And be sure that the scientific method is an invention as much as anything else, as much as any kind of steam engine or kind of chemical process. It wasn't done centuries ago. It had to be developed and invented, because it's by that process of the scientific method, applying that machinery, that we've built the modern world, that we've created antibiotics and aircraft and machinery and this wonderfully successful system of agriculture and transport. And so if you want to recover all those things and, you know, kind of improve the human conditions, you're not scrabbling around in the mud again, you're going to have to apply the scientific method to recover as quickly as possible.
Do you feel like there's other theories that just are, if you only have 20 pages, you better know this other detail after this detail?
I mean, some knowledge is more directly applicable to saving yourself and helping yourself. And then that's the kind of knowledge that I focused on in the book. And if you were limited to only one single notion to tell the people in the immediate aftermath, to try and keep them as healthy and keep them alive as best you can, it would be this idea of the germ theory, that the notion that the reason people get sick and transmit diseases to each other is not because, you know, the fractious will of some whimsical god, or because of bad air, because of, you know, malaria, literally bad air. It's because there are things which are so small you cannot see them with your own eyes. They're invisibly small, these bacteria, these microbes, and they get inside your body and they make you sick. And I explain how to make a very, very rudimentary microscope
to see these
for yourself.
That part.
You can generally do this in your own kitchen if you wanted to. You can make a very simple microscope to see these germs. And with that understanding, and then the basis, therefore, of hygiene and sanitation, the idea that you want to not get bacteria get into your body, you want to absolutely break the kind of pathogen cycle between your own excrement and getting it inside your body, the kind of fecal-oral transfer, it's called. And even in the kind of mid-1800s, 1800s, the kind of mid-19th century, when London was the capital city of the most powerful empire in the world, people were still literally pouring their poo into the Thames,
right,
into the river, and then someone was dipping a bucket 20 yards down, pulling out, drawing that water and drinking it. And you'd get cholera outbreaks, killing hundreds, thousands of people each time, because they didn't have that really simple understanding of transmissible diseases and germs. And you could leapfrog, you know, hundreds of years, centuries of kind of development by just explaining that principle to someone, and more, as importantly, showing them how to demonstrate it for themselves, how to build a basic microscope.
You know, it's funny you say that, because one of the things I liked about your book was you're like, look, we can have 20/20 hindsight here. This is the future. Mm. We can look back and say, future guys, this wheelbarrow is going to be really useful for you. You should do this.
So really simple things, right, exactly, that were developed surprisingly late in history. And it's just such a, in retrospect, it seems so obvious, but it's, yeah, only obvious once you know it. And just like I say, with a few hints, you can really help accelerate a progression.
You know, I wonder, even if we're rebooted back to 10,000 years ago, is our path inevitable, technologically and scientifically speaking, and we're just going to make the same mistakes? We're going to make the same rubber tires and the splitting of the atoms and the same pollution and the same alienation, because it seems like that's what we're going to do.
I mean, I don't know. I suppose in one sense, we've only got one example, one civilization, which has had widespread problems of, you know, global warming, of creating a different environment on the planet, because we've had that capability, and we've invented nuclear weapons, and we are so advanced, we're almost too strong for ourselves, we're almost too advanced for ourselves, that we are creating some problems, some serious problems for ourselves. So we've only really got one example. And if you were to kind of, you know, rewind the DVD of civilization and watch the film from the beginning again, if you were to hit the reboot button and start from scratch, I don't think you can say that it's inevitable. It happened once, but, you know, it could happen completely different a second time around. Perhaps something would be different about society second time around, where they might take a more responsible attitude and not, let's say, kind of start over-exploiting resources. But then again, maybe we will. Maybe there's something inherent about humanity that we're individualistic and we look out for ourselves first and foremost. And a lot of the problems of the kind of modern world, I think, with, you know, kind of pollution and overusing resources, are what's known in game theory as the tragedy of the commons, that you look out for yourself, you put your own interests above the interests of the community, even knowing that if the whole thing crashes, you have as much difficulty as everyone else afterwards, if you see what I mean. And that's the situation we're kind of finding ourselves in today. And I don't know if it would repeat itself if you went back to scratch. I don't want to run that experiment, of course, because I quite like modern civilization. But again, I think it's a really interesting philosophical point that you could argue quite effectively on both sides, I think.
Lewis Dartnell is an astrobiologist and author of The Knowledge, How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch. Charles Monroe Kane spoke with him. So you survived the conversation about survival. But don't go away. Coming up, writer Barbara Ehrenreich and physicist Lawrence Krauss each offer a different take on God. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
To the Best of Our Knowledge proudly presents
Dangerous Ideas.
I'm Lawrence Krauss, and I'm a theoretical physicist, and I think perhaps the most dangerous idea that science has developed, and I'm sure people have been burned at the stake for it, is the notion that you don't have to believe in the supernatural. In fact, it's quite the opposite. As Steve Weinberg has said, science doesn't make it impossible to believe in God, it just makes it possible to not believe in God. Because until you have science, everything that happens is a miracle. But what science has done, and perhaps the most dangerous idea in the history of humanity, and by dangerous I mean wonderful, is that it's told us that physical effects can have physical causes. And indeed, as far as we can tell, all physical effects have physical causes. And if we understand those causes, we can predict the effects. We can create technology and build a world which is either better or worse, depending upon how we govern it. And so that notion that you don't need a supernatural intelligence, but rather that everything can have a physical reason, is dangerous because it also suggests the possibility that when it comes to the universe, there's nothing beyond the physical. And that, for many people, is incredibly dangerous. Nevertheless, I, as an individual, find it incredibly exciting. What is wonderful about that dangerous idea is it leads us to what I think is the ultimate step towards creating a better society. Because if the meaning and purpose in the universe is only that which we create and not created for us, then that means that we have an obligation to create that meaning and an obligation to use our minds to create a better world. So instead of being happy or depressed about a world that was created for us, we can instead enjoy our brief moment in the sun by making it brighter and more exciting. This means that it comes down to us, and that may sound the opposite of humble. But to me, in fact, it's the ultimate in humility. Because if we are cosmically insignificant, what can be more arrogant than assuming a universe created for us? Instead, if we are incredibly insignificant in the universe, if we accept that, we just move along humbly to make our own little space better.
Lawrence Krauss is a theoretical physicist and author of A Universe from Nothing, Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. There are more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week we're thinking about Barbara Ehrenreich's new book, Living with a Wild God. It's the story of a mystical experience she had more than 50 years ago when she was just 17. And the thing is, Ehrenreich has always considered herself an atheist. So as Steve Paulson discovered, this is really a story about how a lifelong atheist has tried to make sense of an experience she can't explain.
Barbara, you've spent most of your career writing about problems of class and gender and inequality, and this was after you got a PhD in cell biology. And I think anyone who's followed your career would have pegged you as a very secular and rationalist thinker, probably someone hostile to religion. And yet now you've written a book about mystical experience. Did you feel like you had to come out of the closet to talk about these experiences you had many years ago?
Oh, yes. These are things I never talked about. These could be interpreted as signs of mental illness. So it was better not to say anything to anybody.
So you didn't even talk about this with your family?
Oh, no. Are you kidding? The last people I would talk about to. No, my parents were very dogmatic atheists. I'm an atheist also, slightly less intolerant one. But they would have mocked me, I'm sure.
And then later on, after you came of age, I mean, there were decades when you presumably were mulling over all of this. Were you worried that you were going to get laughed at if you talked about this mystical experience you had back when you were a kid?
Well, laughed at or diagnosed, you know, patronized in some way at worst, institutionalized. I didn't have good words for it. I won't use terms like spirituality. That's a fairly empty word, and it pretty much creeps me out. So I didn't want to fall back on that. And I certainly was not going to call it an encounter with God. You know, that just didn't enter my mind.
Okay. So take me back to your adolescence when you started having these very unusual experiences. How old were you when they started?
I guess it all started when I was 13 and decided that my mission in life – was to find out the truth about everything. Why are we here? What's the purpose of this? What's going on in this universe? And I thought I was the only one who would ever ask these questions. Now, I don't think any of this is unique to me or even that unusual. But starting when I was about 13, there would be these moments when suddenly a layer would seem to peel off the world. The layer that contains all the words, the language, the meanings, the human significance, that would go away. It seemed like I was seeing things, quote, as they were.
Well, then, skipping ahead a few years, this stayed with you, this sort of response to the world. And then when you were 17, you had a big experience, a mind-blowing experience. Can you set the stage for what happened?
Yes, and I should say that the phrase I finally learned to describe such an experience is, quote, a mystical experience. And it started, well, in a skiing trip. I was with my little brother and a high school friend. We drove from Los Angeles up to Mammoth Mountain. We spent the night in the car in the town of Lone Pine, California. I woke up a little before dawn and started walking around. And I think maybe it's better to read a little passage here from the book.
If you could, yeah, because I know you spent a long time thinking about how to describe this in words. So, yes, if you could read about
this. Yeah. So in the next few minutes on that empty street, I found whatever I'd been looking for since the articulation of my quest. Here we leave the jurisdiction of language. But there is one image handed down over the centuries that seems to apply, and that is the image of fire, as in the burning bush. At some point in my pre-dawn walk, the world flamed into life. How else to describe it? There were no visions, no prophetic voices, just this blazing everywhere. Something poured into me, and I poured out into it. This was not the passive beatific merger with the all, as promised by the Eastern mystics. It was a furious encounter with a living substance, and one reason for the terrible wordlessness of the experience is that you cannot observe fire really closely without becoming part of it. I stopped at some point in front of a secondhand store, transfixed by the blinding glow of the most mundane objects, teacups and toasters. I could not contain it, this onrush. Everywhere, inside and out, the only condition was overflow. Ecstasy would be the word for this, but only if you're willing to acknowledge that ecstasy does not occupy the same spectrum as happiness or euphoria, that it participates in the anguish of loss and can resemble an outbreak of violence.
And you go on to describe this as if you'd been savaged by a flock of invisible angels lifted up in a glorious flutter of iridescent feathers, then mauled, emptied of all intent and purpose, and pretty much left for dead. I mean, it sounds like a shattering experience.
It was shattering. It was hard to think about. And the journal that I had kept when I was a teenager is very evasive about this. At one point, I'll say, I can't go on. I can't go on. I have nothing left to do in this world. Everything is now ugly and empty for me. And at another point, I'd be saying, I want that to happen again. I want to get back there.
And you describe this as an encounter with a living presence. What made you think that?
It felt like there was something there. Now, I didn't think that was a very sane conclusion, so I decided to go with the more conventional type of explanation that I'd had some sort of little mental breakdown, and it wasn't even worth mentioning to anybody.
So that's the way you had sort of written it off in as you constructed the narrative of your own life. Okay, I kind of had this little psychotic breakdown, didn't last long, but let's forget about it, let's move on.
That's right. Not until middle age did I begin to return to this and find myself asking over and over again, maybe there was a kind of encounter. Maybe I should explore that strange possibility a little more.
So why? Why did you conclude that all these years later?
Well, I didn't fully conclude it. but it began to inform other work I was doing. For example, what I was learning about the history of religion. So much of religion had begun with experiences that seemed to be not unlike mine, of being thrilling and terrifying, that were overwhelming.
Now, the fascinating thing to me as I read about your story is that you still call yourself an atheist, even though you're describing this really powerful mystical experience.
Yeah, and I guess this is a good test of my atheism, right? The other thing about atheism here is if I had any sense of an encounter, it was not an encounter with anything good or benevolent.
But I think there's a more common understanding of atheism. I guess a lay understanding is it's an atheist is someone who doesn't believe there's any non-material dimension to reality. There are no otherworldly beings, nothing supernatural. That's not your definition of atheism.
No, I don't think so. In fact, I think it would be a big mistake and has been a big mistake for science to rule out the existence of non-human consciousness and will and agency in this world and perhaps in the universe.
You're really saying it's time for science to open up and it's time for kind of theories of knowledge to expand, that we've become much too narrow in our culture.
Well, yes. And what I say to people now that I've written a book and come out, I understand that a lot of people have these experiences. They never talk about them in most cases, probably for the same reasons I didn't. But if something like this should occur to you and you see sort of this magnificent, transcendent presence, do not fall on your knees. Remain alert. Take notes. There's not any reason to revere or be in awe of something so strange. There's a reason to investigate. There's also the whole New Age movement tends to sort of suck these things up for itself and claim them for itself.
And you're kind of allergic to anything New Age or even talk of spirituality.
Yes, that's right. I want to keep it rational. That's
but it's not rational. The whole thing you've just been talking about is not rational.
Yes, it is. Let's not drop our rationality when we confront the bizarre or the weird. Let's keep right on thinking.
Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of Living with a Wild God. And that interview is part of a longer conversation she and Steve had about atheism and the limits of materialism. You can hear the whole thing on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour. Joe Hartke was our technical director, and they had help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, and Stephanie Youngblood. Our opening theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for spending time with us today.
PRI, Public Radio International.